thanks everyone for coming. I'm very pleased indeed to welcome Professor June McDaniel, who's going to, needs no introduction, I'm sure you're familiar with her work, who's going to speak to us today about Bhakti and Tantra in Balinese Hinduism. June, over to you.
Okay. This research was actually inspired by Gavin, because last time I came and talked here, which was some years back, he asked about Bhakti and Bali and mentioned that it was before the Bhakti movement came to India. So it had a different kind of Hinduism. It didn't have Bhakti. And I was kind of curious about this, so I actually went out and started talking to people, and I said, so, do you believe in Bhakti? If so, what is it? And they turned out to have totally different definitions, which did not deal with emotion. So I decided to write a paper that dealt with the topics of both Bhakti and Tantra, because the Hinduism in Bali is very different than the Hinduism in India. And in fact, it's so different, you kind of wonder if it's still the same thing. And in fact, they're wondering if it's the same thing or whether they should become a different sort of religion or denomination. And that's an ongoing discussion right now. But at any rate, I figured I'd make a paper out of it, and then we could talk about it. So I will read the paper. Bali is an island that has been romanticized in American and European writing, described as the abode of sorcerers, demons, and gods, an emerald drawn from the ocean depths that rests upon the back of a tortoise. It was famously called the Morning of the World by Nehru. It's also a place that has mixed indigenous beliefs with South Indian Shaivism and Tantric Buddhism. In this paper, we'll look at the role of Bhakti and Tantra in popular Balinese Hinduism, called Agama Hindu Bali or Agama Tirtha. Hinduism came to Indonesia before the rise of Bhakti, and it never developed personal devotion to deities as a popular practice. Indonesia today has several types of Hinduism. Tribal groups have affiliated themselves with Hinduism for political reasons, such as the Kaharingan of Kalimantan, the Tana Toraja of Sulawesi, and the Karobatak of Sumatra. In Bali, what is loosely called Hinduism is complex. There we find folk Hinduism with the worship of local ancestors and spirits who are equated with Hindu gods. There's a popular form of Hinduism with elaborate rituals of propitiation and an emphasis on holy water. And there's a government-sponsored Hinduism that emphasizes morality and philosophy. There's an ongoing debate among Hindu practitioners as to whether Balinese Hinduism is an incomplete subcategory of Indian Hinduism or whether it's an independent religion. Still, esoteric bhakti can be found in Bali, especially in the experiences of the Padandas or Brahmin high priests. They are primarily Shaivite, though there are a few Buddha-Shiva priests remaining. Bhakti is combined with the daily ritual identification with Shiva Surya, the Surya Sevana ritual, involving tantric mantras, mudras, pranayam, nash, and buddhashuddhi, or nyasa. The priests transform ordinary water into the holy water, which is needed for virtually all other Hindu rituals in Bali. And in doing so, they not only ritually identify with a god, they also develop a devotional relationship to him. The Surya Sevana ritual includes both bhakti and tantra. This paper will describe the roles of bhakti and tantra from field interviews with practitioners, primarily Balinese Padandas. This paper will argue that the concept of Bali is known in Balinese Hinduism, but it's not primarily associated with emotion. It's associated with sannyas, with dharma, with gyan, with karma, and with yajna. It's almost associated with anything except emotion. The concept of tantra is also known and found primarily in four areas. There is priestly tantra, in which the Padanda identifies himself with the gods in the universe and ritually merges his identity with the god Shiva. There is magical tantra, both black and white, in which mantras, mudras, yantras, and amulets are used to supernaturally influence the world. There is architectural tantra, in which the layout of temples, and indeed the island of Bali itself, is an expression of the mandalas of deities. And there is bodily tantra, in which the Kunda Empat are biological entities which develop along with human souls, spiritually evolving from physiological organs to divine beings. Some brief background on Hinduism in Bali may not be necessary, but in case anybody doesn't have background. There are many theories of how Hinduism came to Indonesia. From the 4th to the 15th centuries, Hindu kingdoms rose and fell there, and the most important was perhaps the Majapahit, based in eastern Java. Hindus from the Majapahit kingdom fled to Bali during the 16th century as Muslim kingdoms in Java gained dominance. As the Majapahit kingdom disintegrated, many of its priests, artists, musicians, and leaders moved to Bali. The Hindu tradition that came to Bali from Java emphasized both Shaivism and Buddhism, but it did not have a broad range of sacred texts from India. Today it has versions of the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, but most other texts are partial, copied onto the old Javanese palm leaf manuscripts or lantars. These texts were formerly held secret by Pedantas, and scholars did not have access to them. In recent years, libraries of lantars have been organized for scholars with texts that have been carefully copied by hand. Some lantar manuscripts have not been donated to libraries, and there are Balians or healers who have their own texts handed down in their families. As Igede Sura, professor of religious education in Bali, noted in an interview, Bali has an incomplete set of Hindu sacred texts. We have no Upanishads here. We have some small parts of the Vedas and Puranas written in old Japanese. In the epics, Rama and Krishna are not gods, but ancient heroes. And we have other gods like Indra as god of rain and Varuna as god of the ocean. Ultimately, all of these are considered to be forms of Shiva. A similar point was made by Ida Bagus Gunara, a professor of Hindu philosophy in Bali. There are no full Vedas, Upanishads, or Puranas in Bali. We have only parts which have been reproduced in the Lantar literature. Our major texts are the epics, not the Shastras, and they are the sources of our values. We have the values of the Vedas too, but not the texts. Perhaps our major value is the importance of the relationship between the teacher and the student. Access to this literature is limited, as most texts are written in old Javanese and Sanskrit, and most Balinese people do not know these languages. There are some scholars that study Lantar texts, especially the tutors or philosophical texts, but mostly they're for priests. In Bali, the Brahmin caste is not a priestly caste. There are priests for each caste. So a Pedanda is a priest for the Brahmins who has taken Diksha or initiation, while a Pamanku is a priest primarily for other castes who serves in the local temples. Then there are other figures that have semi-priestly functions, such as the Balian healer and the Dalang or puppeteer. Usually a husband and wife together are Pedandas for the village. The Pedanda is sometimes described as having taken sannyas, but in Bali, sannyas has a different meaning than in India. In Bali, a sannyasi is a priest who is married and lives in a community. He is neither celibate nor poor. Several informants have said that Bali cannot have hermit sannyasis because the island is too small. There'd be no place for them to go. But Pedandas generally say that they have an obligation to the community. Sannyas does not mean renouncing identity, but it means a stronger group identity, support of the family and village. Sannyas is bhakti in society. One of the guys I spoke to actually spoke English, and that's how he defines sannyas, bhakti in society. Pedantas do not buy and sell, travel alone, or go to popular entertainment, and their families take care of housing and expenses for them. As Ida Pedanda Pemaron Mandara notes, and any title Ida Pedanda means a Brahmin priest. Pedantas seek moksha, but they also have responsibilities. There are no renunciant sadhus or sannyasis in Bali, though there were long ago. India has more focus on individuality, but in Bali, the community demands the presence of the Pedanda. It needs holy water for rituals. The ashram is the house of the priest. Most of the work of the Pedanda is internal. The mandalas of Surya, Chandra, and Agni are visualized rather than drawn. But the holy water is physical, and it's our contribution to the community. Hindu priests do not serve empowered statues in temples. In Bali, the gods do not dwell in statues or images, and there is no pranapratista rite. The gods may come to visit for holidays, but then they leave. As one informant phrased it, statues are like hotels. Gods may visit like tourists visit Bali, but they do not live there. Bali is full of large statues, but these are decorative, and they're used for hotels and restaurants. There are small pratimas where the gods come for holidays, but these are hidden away in temple cabinets and do not receive worship for most of the year. This has the practical effect of making Hindu ritual more acceptable to the Muslim majority in Indonesia, which does not accept image worship. Bhakti. Because Hinduism entered Indonesia before the rise of the Bhakti movement, emotion is not a major aspect of Balinese Hinduism. Informants generally found the idea of having strong emotion for a god to be unsuitable. One should honor the god, but having passion was not a way to respond to a deity. It was a sign of the lower self. Wisdom was superior to emotion, and one should demonstrate knowledge towards a deity, not feelings. According to the Brahmin priest Idapadanda Putra Yoga, bhakti exists, but only as a response to gyan. The Padanda may worship many gods, but they're all emanations of Shiva. This worship is bhakti, but in the Balinese tradition, bhakti is always under the guidance of gyan, or jnana. Otherwise, emotions could become uncontrolled and chaotic. Manas, or mind, may not always be able to control love, but deeper wisdom can control it. Then the mind controls the heart, and emotion is rational. There is no Balinese word prem, and no equivalent concept. The idea of intense emotion, of the prem which is so important in Bengali bhakti, is simply embarrassing in Balinese Hinduism. One would not cry to God like a child. One would not submit to desire for a god in such an undignified way. Balinese tradition is very conservative, and one must always behave honorably before a god. He notes that bhakti would be understood differently for lay people and priests. In lay people, it comes with action, the creation of offerings, or banten, which are these little wrapped-up offerings they leave in a lot of places in Bengal. It's not a separate emotion. It's fused with the karma from making the offerings of palm leaves and ritual. However, it arises in padandas through initiation. The path of practice begins with diksha by a guru. It's a journey inward, a process of becoming purified through ritual action. Okay, this is quoting the priest again. The goal is to become Shiva, who is ultimate purity, and he is found in emptiness, or shunya. From birth, we are entangled in impurity, and mantras help to make us pure. Those who hope to become Shiva develop feelings of bhakti in the heart. They focus on his symbol, such as the Bijakshara mantra and Shiva's Rudrakshas. Every morning, they perform the Surya Sevana ritual and identify with the god. Shiva is not outside, but within. He's the essence of all, like the liquid in a mango. He pervades the world and the three bodies. And there's a poem that expresses this. In the midst of the fire is the sun. In the midst of the sun is the moon. In the midst of the moon is pure light. And in the midst of pure light is Shiva. As Idapadanda Putra Yoga notes, priestly bhakti can lead to mystical union. There are many types of love for God. In the Bhuvana Kosha, the Lord is described as father, friend, brother, sister, and master. For us, all types of bhakti are fused together, but the most important relationship is son to father. In bhakti, there's always a distance between the person and the god. We use vertical metaphors. The god is higher than the person. Such hierarchy affects our understanding of the relationship between the person and the god. This hierarchy or stratification is also shown in language, and one cannot communicate directly about such states because of the limitations of language. People communicate with Lord Shiva in two main ways. One is dominated by feelings. We request things from him or beg him for favors. In this approach, the focus is on personal desire. The other way is to approach Lord Shiva through identification. Shiva comes down to the priest, and the priest embodies Shiva and chants his words. The priest becomes close to Shiva in this way, which requires spiritual purity and maturity. In the highest state of liberation, one becomes so close to Lord Shiva that he merges with him, and no individuality remains. The self is like the wind moving through the bamboo plants, both outside and inside. As the priest Idapadanda Pemaron Mandara states, one can speak with Shiva in samadhi during yogic meditation. There's a direct encounter, and it's very personal. If the person is impure, he cannot see God. If he's pure, he can sense the presence of the Lord. If he's very pure, he can sense the presence of the god and also see him. But sometimes there's illusion or fantasy in meditation, and one must be certain that jnana or wisdom is present to determine the truth of the experience. Bhakti is also associated in Bali with ancestor worship. Bali has a strong tradition of offerings to ancestors who depend on their descendants for entrance into afterlife worlds. And there's this double burial phenomena in Bali, if anybody wants to know more about that. According to Professor Igede Sura, bhakti in Bali was originally focused on ancestors. It later developed towards the Bhattara and Bhattari, the gods and goddesses. Bhakti is shown in offerings which hold surrender, devotion, and often a wish for something. The major type of offering is bantan, which comes from prayachita, or penance, asking for blessing and purification. It is not the person, but the bantan, which contains the bhakti. An interesting notion. The emotion is in the object. Ancestors are worshipped by Balians, our healers. They chant mantras called Saha in Balinese. These connect the person to the ancestor or god. Balinese ancestor worship led to the worship of gods and goddesses, the Dewa and Devi. The Sanskrit concept of Atman mixed with the Balinese Hyang to create the Dewa Hyang, are words for gods and goddesses. So Hyang is actually an old Balinese Japanese word. Ancestors are enshrined in family temples where they're worshipped. Ideally, the ancestor has merged with Shiva, so ancestor and deity worship are identical. Shivam, Pitaram, Rupam. We see Shiva in the form of the ancestor. They're kind of the same thing. Balinese bhakti also deals with sacrifice, the willingness to give up what you love for what is best. Bhakti is surrender through symbols, especially for priests. As Ida Bagus Gunara said, bhakti is the sacrifice of things we love. We must renounce emotion for the sake of the god. This is the symbolism of animal sacrifice, giving up a creature that's young and pure as we give up our personal feelings and surrender. So bhakti doesn't mean emotion, it means giving up emotion. Thus, bhakti as emotion is not part of Balinese Hinduism, but it can be found in priestly tantric ritual. So we move on to Tantra. The four types of Tantra described here each have their own deities, supernatural maps, and sets of worlds. Each tantric style of practice has skilled practitioners who describe and hand down the traditions. So, priestly Tantra. We see both Shaiva and Buddhist Tantra in Bali. Tantric ritual is present in many forms of worship, but is perhaps most visible during the daily Suryasevana ritual. In this ritual, the priest transforms ordinary water into holy water, which is required for virtually all Hindu rituals in Bali. The exact moment of transformation is debated by modern Pedandas, at least among the ones that I spoke to. Some say that the water is transformed during the mantras. Some say by Shiva entering the heart. Some say by the vision of Shiva and Uma together, and some by the visualized descent of Ganga. So there's different theories as to when this transformation happens. The emphasis is on mantra and visualization, but bhakti as emotion is often there too, especially towards the guru, as Ida Padanda Pemaran Mandara notes. In Shaiva meditation, the body is equated with the universe, and we recognize that gods live in parts of the body. Using visualization and bija mantras, the gods come to dwell in every part of the body. These mantras are given at Diksha, and they're later passed down in teachings by the guru. There are secret mantras which should only be passed down as words of the guru. The bodies of the gods are made of mantras. One has bhakti towards the guru, which is seen in serving him and showing compassion, or seva and karma. The combination of tantra and bhakti can bring union with Shiva. According to Ida Padanda Gede Putra Trachpa. Here in Bali, we practice Shiva Buddha Tantra. The vision of Shiva is like a shared cosmic smile. And that one he did in English. We have the search for moksha as a part of daily life. There's no terminology for renunciation. We have temporary separation during prayer, and we seek to become a part of the huge cosmic soul, which is Shiva. The only real separation that we have is at death, when the soul flows out of the body like a river. The Brahmin priest Ida Padanda Jalantak Dwaja is a Shiva Buddha priest, a dying lineage in Bali. He says, there's only one Brahmin Buddhist village remaining in Bali, here in Buddha Kaling, which is where I went to interview him. Most of the Padanda Buddha priests of Bali who worship both Buddha and Shiva live here. There are perhaps 15 remaining Padanda Buddha priests from what was once an important Buddhist tradition. So this merge type is starting to die off. Ida Padanda Jalantak Dwaja wears gold and white. He says, Buddha and Shiva are one, Nirvana and Moksha are one. In early Buddhism, there was no soul, but later we've come to accept the mind as soul, and he uses the word atma. The ancient Buddhism that came to us here was Mahayana, with links to Vajrayana. Our three practices have been Mantrayana, Vajrayana, and Kalachakra. We worship both the Panch Tathagata, the five Buddhas of creation, and the god Shiva. We have love towards them both, but without attachment. Like the Hindu Pandandas, his major ritual function is to create holy water. He notes, during the holy water ritual, I sit in Padmasana and I meditate on purification. I then become the ritual embodiment of the Buddha and do meditation upon the highest aspect of Buddhahood as Parama Buddha or as Shunya. Parama Buddha is the center of all mandalas. There's an inner visualized mandala and an outer mandala. Diksha is necessary to create the inner mandala, though the outer mandala can be learned from texts. One of the most important texts for this is the Sangyang Kamahayanikan. It can only be understood through the teaching of the guru. In Bali, we worship the five Tathagatas together. There is no focus on individual worship. However, each has different mantras and mudras. They are worshipped in both Shaiva and Buddhist rituals. We also do puja to Surya, Giripati, Ganga, and other deities. There is the earthly Buddha, the Adi Buddha, and the Parama Buddha. Buddhists can perform rituals for Shaivas, and Parama Buddha can give grace, use the word anugraha, to worshippers as Parama Shiva can. So, in this fusion, Buddhism accepts tantric ideas, and the image of the Vajra is important. The Vajra has remained an important symbol. It's even found on ritual bells used by Hindu Shaiva priests. However, Shaiva Tantra is much more common than Shiva Buddha Tantra. While in the Shaiva form of the ritual, the god Shiva is understood to enter the priest and act through him. In the Buddhist form, there's no entrance of the deity. However, both types of priests that I interviewed use the term shunya, or in Bengali, sunya, in Balinese, sunya, for the ultimate state. Both types use visualization. In the Buddhist form, Sangyang Buddha is imagined at the top of the head, invisible and void, and both body and water are purified through mantras, mudras, and the invocation of both Hindu and Buddhist deities, especially the five celestial Buddhas called Nadhyani, but Gyan Buddhas. Both types of priests use Sanskrit, Javanese, and Balinese mantras. Recognizable ones from Hindu Tantra include Om Ahum and Hum Fat, or sometimes Hurum Buddha. One interesting ritual has the Buddhist priest holding the Vajra and bell and chanting that Brahma and Vishnu are the offering and Maheshvara is the eater. A more local form of Tantra is magical Tantra. Magical Tantra, or as it's called there, Tantra Vidya, is known throughout Indonesia. It's still an active tradition in Bali, on the island of Lombok, and in Java. There are white and black magic practiced by dukuns. White magic tends to deal with fortune-telling, love, and healing massage, while black magic may be responsible for disasters such as sudden death, crop failures, diseases, and marital problems. Both make use of amulets and mantras, usually written in special liquids on fabric and paper, and such mantras are often considered to be alive. In Java, black magic is usually either sihir, which causes death, or rapu, which causes illness and suffering. The dukun gains supernatural powers by long periods of meditation and fasting. Such knowledge may be learned directly through spirits or through hidden books that are handed down in the family. Payment is voluntary and there are no set wages. He or she will be punished by the village if he's found to have used destructive powers on members of his own village. And his opponent is the Hindu priest or the Muslim kiai, the person with spiritual knowledge of Islam, especially Sufism, and who can call on ancestors, angels, saints, and prophets. Black magic, sometimes called guna guna, makes use of cursed objects, hair, and amulets. Chanting the traditional 500 mantras, the black dukun sits on a sharp knife and visualizes his or her goal. One form of magic described in an interview with an Indonesian anthropologist has the male practitioner visualize a woman roll a tomato in his hands and concentrate on it. This will cause orgasm at a distance, and eventually the woman will become fascinated by the magician. There are also dukuns associated with alternative medicine and local Kajawan teachings for protection, wealth, and summoning spirits. In Bali, pedandas have the power to keep evil spirits away, and daily offerings at intersections and doorways protect people from curses by evil dukuns. The tantric practitioner is considered to be kasaktian, full of shakti or power learned from tantra vidya, and may be a balayan or healer, or a more ambiguous form of dukun. Initiation often involves having a mantra whispered into the fontanelle or sahasrara chakra of the initiate. The Gayatri mantra may be used as a spell, and there are mantras for invulnerability, forging a kriss knife, and becoming possessed by a god. Magical objects may be found on pilgrimage to sacred places, especially old Hindu ritual sites, and one unusual one is the Mani Gaja, or elephant stone, made from the sperm of an elephant. Those who are Kasatiyan may not bleed if stabbed with a knife, and are believed to have the ability to shift their shape to animals, birds, other people, even machines. While kris daggers are more Malaysian than Indonesian, we still hear of the Balinese Empu metalworker caste that forges them, and the supernatural powers that may be associated with them. They can move of their own will, stand upright when their true names are called, accept offerings, and hold spirits and ancestors. As Hoikas notes, dark magic is Pangiwa, often attributed to Durga, who is a death goddess in Bali. The person dedicated to Durga becomes a Layak, or shapeshifter, appearing as an animal, a flaming ghost, or a vampire. One can also cast curses on evil people, especially criminals, through the god Bayu Bajrasakti, who will burn them to death. While Tantra deals with the invocation of deities through mantra, mudra, and yajna, the practitioner is ritually purified and can learn mantras for specialties, such as invisibility, liberation from curses, easy childbirth, returning lost children, gaining victory, seeing invisible things, restraining waters, flight, returning lost souls to their bodies, and entering another person's body. Mantras invoke protector deities like Nilakanta, and drawings are also used, and these show the bodies of deities that are mirrored vertically and horizontally in order to reverse curses and problems. So you'll have like this middle part, there'll be something up from the waist on the top, and then on the bottom, there's the waist to the head also, but it's upside down. And this is a way of reversing curses in their Tantra Vidya. While women may become witches, they may also become Tantra goddesses. The Mas Kumambang mantra is used by women. The woman chants that she is like the moon with ultimate power, wearing the robes of the goddess Pearl of the World and gold ornaments, flying invisibly and drinking the nectar of the gods, and her presence fills the world. Architectural Tantra. We go on. Bali is an island full of temples. The Department of Religion has cataloged at least 11,000 temples, small and large, local and regional. Balinese temples are not closed buildings, but rectangular courtyards open to the sky, with rows of shrines and altars dedicated to various gods and deities. On festival days, the congregation of each temple assembles to pray and to entertain the visiting deities. Bali has six major temples called the Sad Kahyangan, or the six temples of the world. They have tiered shrines called Meru, which symbolize the world mountain, Gunung Mahameru. Sometimes the temples are understood as petals of a cosmic lotus superimposed on Bali, an idea attributed to Dangyang Nurartha, traditional founder of the Balinese Shaivite priesthood in the 1500s. The layout of the temple is called the Sangamandala. It's a spatial concept that divides the temple into nine parts according to eight major cardinal directions in the center. Many temples have gods of the directions called the Devata Navasanga, who also appear in the symbol of the Hindu Majapahit Empire called the Surya Majapahit. All of them are understood to be emanations of Shiva with tantric mantras, mudras, colors, and powers. Well, leave it at that. Okay, bodily tantra. While the previous types of tantra require training, meditation on the Kanta Ampat are found throughout the Balinese society. This would be more ambiguous as a form of Tantra. It would depend on the definition. If we look at the Bengali Sahajiya understanding of Tantra, in which the gods dwell in the body and a good part of sadhana is recognizing them and identifying with them, then practices involving these bodily deities could fit into that category. They also have some tantric influence in their origin. Christian Huygens links them to Pashupata Shaiva Tantra. The Khanda Empat are four internal spirits, which begin initially as physiological beings and evolve into spiritual ones. They have different names in the womb, at birth, and as the child grows. They are conceived along with the child and begin as the placenta, the uterine blood, the fat layer, and the amniotic fluid. At birth, these older siblings become Angapati in the heart, Banaspati in the kidneys, Banaspati Raja in the bile, and Rajapati in the liver. Depending on the person's treatment of them, they can become the Khanda Empadeva, or gods, or the Khanda Empadbhutas, or evil spirits. There are folk stories of them being gods or sages cursed to live in human bodies. According to Ida Padanda Putra Yoga, there are gods that can dwell in the body, and also the Khanda Empat. They are bodily guardians, both internal and external, and they influence the organs of the body. They're found at birth with the placenta, amniotic fluid, fat layer, and blood that allow the baby to live. They grow along with the child, starting out biologically, developing souls, and eventually becoming gods and accompanying the soul to the heavens. The four Khanda Empat protect the person through life from illness and evil spirits if they are invited during ceremonies and honored. They exist invisibly, influencing the person's life. They are guardians who reflect the person's spiritual growth. They can evolve into gods or become degenerate. If you forget them, they will not help you. They should be remembered during the daily Bhantan rituals. According to the Tuturpanas Karma Lantar, when the person dies, he or she is accompanied by the Khanda Empat. When the soul returns to heaven, the Khanda Empat names will be Shunya Siwa, Sada Siwa, Parama Siwa, and Siwa. Conclusions. In Bali, bhakti is rarely linked to strong emotion. This understanding of bhakti is only found among the high priests, and even then it's a rare event linked to Shaivite mysticism. Bhakti is found in sannyas, in the renunciation of ordinary life for the priesthood. This means living in community with one's wife as a group resource and being responsible for the concerns and daily life of the village. It's linked with wisdom, jnana, as control over unseemly and inappropriate actions towards the god. It's associated with sacrifice, or yajna, giving up what one values most for the sake of the god. And it's found through karma, especially in the action of giving daily bhantan offerings, which is one's dharma or moral responsibility. Bhakti is not something separate from action, it's within the action, and it's generated by it. Balinese Tantra is a tradition found in different dimensions of life, practiced by priests, by sorcerers, by architects, and by all Balinese Hindus who accept the existence of the Khanda Empat. While deities may not be embodied in statues, they are in human bodies, in temple mandalas, in ritual daggers and mantras, and in the emptiness of the heart merged with the god. Tantra creates the holy water, which is the eternal Ganga, thus linking Bali with its spiritual origins in India. And it's also associated with Amrit, nectar of immortality, which connects the person and the gods. Such linking should be a daily event, and it's a great problem of modernity that people travel, and they cannot get their fresh holy water, or carry pre-made holy water on the airplane because of security restrictions. Thus we see the same words have different meanings, and that Hindu concepts change and adapt as they travel. Bhakti and Tantra may be understood in new ways under the influences of history, indigenous cultures, and artistic imagination. Thank you.
Thank you, June, for a very interesting paper. That was, it reminded me, this is almost as if in Bali you've got a sort of earlier layer of Hinduism preserved, as it were, it's almost as if you're going back in time with this, I'm thinking.
Well, there's Agni and Surya,
yes,
and these other guys.
Yes, it's all your typology of tantric traditions. You find that in all these tantric texts, the same sort of things, you know, going on. So, I thought that was very interesting. And that the idea of bhakti is that lack of emotion. And it's more like reverence or something like that.
Well, it can be. Or it's, I mean, the term they use most was dharma.
Oh, okay.
It's really our responsibility, and your responsibility deals with your actions. So your bhakti is found in your actions, which are your obligation. And Balinese society is really run by this idea of obligation. And it's kind of because they grow up with all this guilt. And guilt is because you haven't spent enough money to burn your ancestors properly, so they're living in these little spirit houses that look like mailboxes. And they're kind of stuck there, they're unhappy. And it's your obligation as a descendant to do all the stuff for your ancestors. So everybody kind of grows up with all this responsibility. And most people never have enough money because the kind of rituals they expect to have, these statues are like 20 feet high and nobody can ever afford them. So you go through generations and generations of people having this obligation to their ancestors that they can't ever fulfill. So they're constantly making little offerings as ways to getting back to the big necessities.
Sorry, what is the big... What's the expense exactly that they would have to do in order to do the ritual fully and properly?
Well, they have this kind of double burial phenomena. The first one merely gets rid of the body. The second one actually gets the soul into heaven. And in order to get the soul into heaven, it has to be properly accompanied. So you need not only these big statues that the body is put in, but you need these banks of priests chanting, and you need these big processions, and all of these things cost a lot of money. So people can do the first burial, the first ritual, which takes care of the body. But the souls are all still waiting there to get into heaven, and they're dependent on the descendants.
A lot of souls in little body waiting.
So they never get into heaven, the souls.
Well, I mean, to me those things look like mailboxes, but to them it looks like other things. And, yeah, they're all sitting around waiting.
So they just build up. There's a backlog of ancestors, then, as it were.
Absolutely. And every time they have a major disaster, you know, like a volcano exploding or an earthquake, or like in the 1960s they had these massive riots where a lot of people were killed, we end up with this massive soul backlog.
Wow.
Everybody's got to take care of it. Yeah.
Sorry for if this is a bit of a wacky question, but do you know anything about the use of hallucinogenics in religious practice in Bali? Because I know that mushrooms are rife there at certain times of the year, and it always just seems like a very, I don't know, shamanic culture in some ways.
Well, the difficulty is Bali is part of Indonesia. And Indonesia is primarily a Muslim culture that is very conservative. So the rules against drugs are very strict, that anybody caught with drugs can be thrown into jail and you kind of never see him again. So
but
we have...
The mushrooms are on sale there. There's like signs saying, "Fresh, get your fresh mushrooms here." All across the... and even with, like, I've seen policemen sitting in front of mushroom stalls, but just letting people come and buy mushrooms at certain times of the year during mushroom season.
Well, you know,
there's
this
mushrooms
is.
And then there's mushrooms.
Yeah. No, but they're being advertised like, "Your magic mushroom." They spell them mashrooms, M-A-S-H.
Well, see, this is part of the problem of the tourist presence in Bali, because the tourists have values that the local people don't, and they are continually coming into conflict. And actually, drugs are one of the ways that they come into conflict, because if you talk to the Shiva priest, they're horrified at this, because they believe that you are supposed to be disciplined and controlled, and they believe that drugs will take away from that control. Now, if we go back to India and go up to Manali, sure, lots of people will be taking drugs, and they will say, "Yeah, hey, I'm Shiva, no problem." But in Bali, being Shiva isn't the same thing. And at least among the people who are part of traditional religion, they're very much against it. But most of the writing that we see about Bali today does come from writing about tourists and tourism and what tourism is doing to Bali. So the anthropology that we see very rarely deals with this kind of information. And what it deals with is, let's look at the big hotels and let's look at the yoga practices that the tourists are bringing in. So Bali is also understood to be a big center for Hatha yoga, whereas in fact they have no tradition of Hatha yoga. But now it's known around the world as a center for Hatha yoga because the tourists came in. So yeah, there are these different levels of what kinds of practice we have. And actually studying tourist religion would be an interesting thing to do. But I'm actually looking at the traditional religion here.
Of course, And what time did Hinduism come to Bali? Sorry to ask a historical question.
Yeah, I see. 14th, 15th century around there. I've got the date in there somewhere. Sure. It was with the fall of the Majapahit. So they had this empire that was in Java. But then what happened was Java basically got overrun by Muslims. And the Hindu kingdom fled onto the island of Bali. And there they started developing a new form of Hinduism. So it was already a different form when it was in Java. And then once it moved to Bali, it became different again. And the big problem was, what kinds of texts do we use and who do we consider to be a god? And that's part of the change that happened, because Rama and Krishna aren't gods. They're historical figures, and that way the Muslims can come and they can go see the shadow puppets, because most of the shadow puppets deal with the epics. And if they were gods, then they couldn't go see the epics, and there'd be all kinds of problems. But
are they not gods because of the Muslims, so they can continue to talk about Rama and Krishna? So was that kind of an interpretation to suit the Muslim thing, or was that something that had developed before?
It's an interesting sort of question. I asked some of the priests about that, and nobody seemed to know. All they know is, well, hey, for as long as we've known, Rama and Krishna are heroes, they're great heroes of our past, and there's no problem with the Muslims because of that. Mm-hmm. So it would be an interesting question when it changed. Yeah. I don't know if anybody knows.
I think it's the only scenario I know where that's the interpretation. Just in the Muslim context, it might have just been an interesting, so many places made so many arrangements when the Muslims came into India. That could have been an arrangement that was made that it could still do all kinds of things. And they just secularized Rama and Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, even the way they do the epics has kind of changed there. You know, they have these dalongs, these puppet masters. And there was one that I saw where they were working on the Pandava story, which is what they call it. And then on a break in the midst of the story, the dalang came out, the puppet master, and he was wearing this leather jacket. And he had this guitar, and he was surrounded by dry ice, so full of smoke coming out. And he kind of jumped out, and he started acting like a rock star. So we had this kind of back and forth between the ancient and the modern. And there were all these Muslim politicians sitting there with their little black hats on, and they're kind of, they're all fine with it. So there are these kind of interesting cultural combinations.
You mentioned Bali being sort of superimposed with a mandala conception. I think you said, is there something deeper there in their sense of our island is a kind of center of the universe or anything? Is there any Iliadian component to their we are actually in the center, and this is the island, and this is a natural mandala, anything like that?
We do see it in some of the books. Actually, I didn't read the whole paper because I knew we had to leave a little early. But one of the things that I have somewhere here, they have the outline in the temples. So they have this tree mandala concept of architecture. They have the Nishta Mandala, they call the Jaba Pisan, which is the outer zone, the Madhya Mandala, the Jaba Tenga, which is the middle zone, and the Uttama Mandala, or Jero, the holiest and most sacred zone. And they see that this structure of the temples reflects the structure of the island. And Balinese temples usually contain the Padmasana, the high lotus throne of Shiva or Sanyang Widiwasa, which is what their major god is called today. So they tend to have the mountain, which is called Mount Agung, which is the central mountain of the island of Bali, equated with the lotus throne of Shiva. And in fact, the mountaintop is considered the highest place to be because it's closest to the gods. If you go to the beach, that's where the demons are. And that's one of the reasons they don't like the Australians, who are always at bars by the beach, because they're always going out to the water where the demons are. They also have these palingi meros, these multiple roof towers with these Vajra symbols on them. And it's said that the structure of the island harmonizes the three worlds, Bura, Bva, and Sva. They don't have it as Bva, it's Bwa. But basically, you have the three worlds and you have the three sections of the temples. And the alternate folk story is that they're on a very big tortoise. If you ever wonder where that tortoise story comes from.
It's the tip of the iceberg, it's the top of the back of the tortoise.
Yep, and it's tortoises and elephants going down.
Tortoises all the way down.
You mentioned the use of the word, I think, Saha in, as a mantra, and that kind of goes back to the Swaha, I would assume.
But I would assume.
Right. In terms of practices, like, you know, rituals, how similar is it to kind of the Vedic rituals that we find in, say, in a Namudiri Brahmin context? You know, if the Hinduism of Bali came before Bhakti, how much of it has gotten fossilized there, and, you know, how much of it has, I mean, you mentioned something about Balinese kind of cultural artifacts entering that Hinduism, but how much of it has, you know, kind of remained the same, in your opinion?
Well, we don't see the home fires, we don't see the kind of fire rituals that you see from Vedic times, but we do see the same use of mantras.
Okay.
And the same kind of invocation of deities that way. But, I mean, I guess that would be a whole question of going through the list of all the rituals that they have and all the rituals that other people have. So, obviously some of it came because they still have the same gods. And along with the same gods, they have the same mantras, or they have their version of the same mantras. But it's the rituals towards them that seem to have changed.
And what kind of rituals would they be like, you know, in a Vedic context, we say Swaha and Purghi in the fire, right? What would happen here?
Their central ritual is the Surya Sevana ritual. And the Surya Sevana ritual is not an active ritual. You sit and, you know, you can watch the guy, and I watched a bunch of people do this. And what they're both mostly doing is meditating and putting sacred objects onto the altar. But it's understood that inwardly they're identifying with the god. And there are these different stages of it, where there's Shiva and there's Uma and there's Ganga, and there's all these different identifications. But what's interesting about this ritual is that the holy water they come up with is understood to have the equivalence to the seven major rivers of India. So when you use the holy water that has been transformed through this ritual, you have access to the seven holy rivers of India, which makes Bali ritually India. So everything that's using these things is actually linked to India. So they don't have, like, the same rituals as in India, but they have rituals that are fusing them with India. And no ritual can go on in Bali, or no significant ritual, unless they have that holy water. So even if they don't consider themselves theoretically linked, they have to be ritually linked. Yeah.
Sorry. Another historical question. I'm sorry to. What part of India is the source of this Hinduism? Actually, do we have any? Does it, if that question makes sense?
Yeah. It's mostly South Indian. Part of what interested me is because I work on Bengal. On Bengali Vaishnavism and Bengali Shaktism. Sure. And nobody in Bengal that I ran across was interested in Shiva. So I came over here. Whoa, they're all interested in Shiva. Let's see him.
But then in what sense hasn't Bhakti... Okay, so maybe not the Bhakti movement. I mean, if the sort of late medieval period or surely there's a Bhakti already that's in South India by the time... You know, I mean, thinking of the Alwars, the Bhagavata Purana... What else would it be? Various forms of Shaiva Bhakti.
Didn't come as a wave in the sense that it covered everybody else. The question is, you know, which groups left? And were they bhakti groups?
Yeah.
Were they groups who accepted this as an approach, or were they more traditional groups who said, this is just some modern innovation, you know, we'll ignore it.
Yeah.
And it seems to be the more conservative people who left South India to go to Java, where they had their empire for several hundred years before they ended up going to Bali.
Okay. Is there any link with Orissa by any chance? There's always been an association I've made. Maybe it's just entirely in my own imagination, that there just seems to be some kind of phenomenological parallels in terms of, or just the way things look.
Okay.
Orissa and Bali. Do you have any idea of a link there?
None that I've ever seen. I mean, Oriya art is very interesting, but
yeah.
I never saw much link between Oriya art and Balinese art.
Okay, well, maybe that's just my own subjective.
Well, it'd be an interesting thing to explore sometime.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm curious about the seeming popularity of Garuda in Bali, but maybe that's a part of the tourism thing. There's a shop, and there's a production shop where they make all these Garuda images that you now see all over the world made of wood. I visited when I was there so many years ago, and I wondered if that's... I know, it's Garuda Airlines and so on, but I wondered if Bali has some special identification with Garuda.
I think it's part of the Majapahit symbolism, but in terms of anybody actually worshipping, I never ran across anybody actually worshipping Garuda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should actually note, perhaps, the last talk I gave on Bali, which was some years back, talked about what was going on in terms of modernization, and I didn't really talk about that here, but just to put in a few words. The government in Indonesia follows this Pancasila. Pancasila are the five basic laws of Indonesia. And the first one is belief in one almighty God. And as a compromise, what they said was, we don't care which God it is, so long as there's one of them. The name doesn't matter. It's the number that matters. So if you have the right number, you're okay. And this worked out okay with Islam, Christianity. They actually distinguish between Catholic and Protestant. Hinduism wanted to be accepted by the government because otherwise the Muslims would keep trying to proselytize them, and this could get on their nerves. So they said, we've got to be monotheistic. And they had to debate how to become monotheistic. So what they did was they figured out a god that would be an Indonesian version of a Hindu god whose name was Sanghyang Widiwasa. So the main god is Sanghyang Widiwasa in Indonesia. Specifically in Bali. So they say, really, all these other Hindu gods that we're talking about are just symbols of this one god. And the one god is ethical, and the one god believes in Dharma, and the one god says that you should worship the guru and the government. And there's all these rules that allow the government to support this. So the kind of Hinduism that is being taught in the schools is totally different than what people practice. And I actually went over a whole bunch of textbooks of what was being taught in the schools, and that's somewhere in the Journal of Hindu Studies, talking about the way they're organizing it for the modern world. So that's what the modern world is doing. Then I figured I'd see what else they're doing, and this is what they're actually doing. So Bali exists in multiple levels. So we've got the official religion. We've got the religion as practiced by the Shiva priests, which is very little known by anybody. I mean, just nobody studies these guys. We then have the popular religion with all the trance rituals and the mushrooms. You know, this is the stuff that tourists like to look at with the big cremations. And then we have the whole folklore magical side, which is very important to the locals, and mostly the tourists don't look at them too much except for the dukuns that tell them about their ancestors, or, you know, tell them how to cure diseases. So the religion exists kind of in these multiple levels, and we can study it through all of them. But I figured I would mention that this government Hinduism exists, and if you ask anybody in Bali officially, that's what they're going to tell you.
But is there then the sort of danger of like all the other forms are going to be eroded over time. If all these kids are learning the official religion, you would think in a generation that not so many are going to be practicing these other forms anymore.
This is a great concern to people who are there. They say, well, you know, we all know it's a compromise. And they say, well, okay, you know, philosophically we can more or less say Sanyang Wiwasa is the one Hindu god. But, you know, we know what's really true in the home. But they say, how many generations can we go through this before people stop remembering what Hinduism is and they think all it is, you know, this set of dharmic rituals where you support the political leaders? So that is absolutely a question people are concerned with. In fact, two of the questions I found people most concerned with were, is Hinduism dying out and becoming this, you know, government Hinduism? And is Balinese Hinduism a separate religion from India, or are we really dependent on them, and do we need all those Upanishads that we never got and all those other pieces of books that we never got? Like, would we be a better religion if we had them? And they really ask those questions. And I don't know if anybody's come up with any answers, but there's a lot of people who ask.
It must be very confusing for kids. Imagine if you're learning all about this Sanyang Wiwasa, then you have to go home and do something. It's very, it's almost develop a kind of split personality.
Well, I ask people around there, and you know, people are kind of open to talking. And I ask taxi drivers and sculptors and fishermen, and people I ran across. What they all do is they forget what they learned in school. They said, that was in school. I learned it. I had to learn it. I forgot it. I don't remember it. I don't want to think about it.
Okay, yeah.
So,
like most things in school.
Yeah, so I like math, you know, algebra.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they've forgotten a lot of it.
Okay.
But, you know, is this going to go on forever? You know, or is anybody going to manage to have some kind of middle ground Hinduism where they can include India, where they can include the more modern gods in Hinduism, you know, where they can include the other texts? It's an interesting sort of question. Or will the tourists just swamp them and, you know, it'll just become a center of Raja and Hatha Yoga?
Or just the government changes its policy to be a little bit more accommodating and broaden its conception of what a religion is.
Well,
surely that could be a fairly easy argument to make.
It's your next project.
Next project, yeah.
Well, this is the biggest Muslim country in the world, and really what they're doing is trying to resist the propaganda from Saudi Arabia. Now, not to get into the political side, which is yet another side, but they are swamped by Muslim books that are coming from the Saudis that are written in Indonesian, talking about how the one true God is Allah, how you should hate everybody else. So for those of you who keep track of Salafi Islam, as it's been coming out of the Middle East, these people are stuck with a lot of these books. What they do is they donate them to the high schools, and the high schools don't have money, so they take these books. And they're teaching this really narrow form of Islam. Indonesian Islam is the liberal form. You know, you're saying, can't they liberalize? Actually, this is the liberal form, because the Salafis are saying to get rid of the Hindus and the Buddhists. And the Buddhists, as a notion, have come up with a one God also. The Confucians have come up with a one God. The Taoists are trying. All they've got is a goddess so far, but they're in process. So that's the compromise.
Wow. Well, who's the Buddhist god? Nirvana Dave.
Actually, he's called Sanyang Adi Buddha.
Sanyang Adi Buddha.
Yeah. Sanyang is their word for kind of holy or divine. And Adi Buddha means primordial Buddha. And they found like this one Vajrayana text that talked about the Adi Buddha. And they said, it's ancient. We found it. We've got a god. And
he was always there.
And now the government is fine with them, but the Buddhists are not fine with each other. Mm. Now the Hindus all kind of got together and said, yeah, all right, we'll accept Sanyang Wiwasa. Good enough, he's symbolic. But the Buddhists won't do that. And we see all these Buddhist groups who are fighting out whether they should say, look, it's really nirvana, it's really empty, or we should say, well, we'll tell the government he's a god, but he's not. And, you know, they've got at least 9 major schools of Buddhism, and they're all fighting with each other, so they can't even come out with a curriculum. I went to one of their colleges where they were trying to write up a curriculum, and and there was so much infighting, they haven't done it yet.
Fascinating stuff.
All in one little island. It's really small island.
It's true, it is. That's why they can't find any place to renounce. There's no place to go.
That's where there's the beach. You can just renounce everything.
Hang out with the demons.
There's a beach here, sorry.
The demons. The Australian demons.
Yeah, you have the beach, you have the mushrooms.
Yeah,
and
exactly. And you have Sung Young Witty Class.
Okay, so I think our MC has left.
Yes.
So somebody else has to go take that role and officially end.
Yes. Thank you very much, June. Thank you very much for those. Sun Young Woody Wada, I had never heard the term, apart from all the other very interesting things and a good interaction session. Thank you very much for coming.
Okay. Very so successful. Another kind of interview.